Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for August the 10th, 2020. This is Air Force veteran David Corey along with my co-host Richard Hurley. Thank you for joining us this evening. Let's first go over to Richard Hurley. Hello, Richard. How goes it?
Hey, David. How you doing tonight? And how's everybody doing out there in podcast land? These are crazy times. Every week we tell you it's just amazing what I hear from week to week. But tonight we do have lots of news and information for you veterans and the families of you veterans. First of all, I want to once again remind everybody that this is a call-in show that welcomes your views, comments, and questions. So you can call us at any time during the show at 1-888-627-6008. Again, that toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. You know, we have lots of news and information for you, so you might want to comment about some of the information we have for you. But you also might want to tell us about if you're a veteran and you've got a claim pending, you might want to call in and talk to us about that. Tell us what your experiences are dealing with the VA. I'm sure we can all relate to each other. But before we, at this point, let's go back to David for some good news.
Well, thanks, Richard. Just before I turn to the news, I was just thinking of the month and the year that we're in now, August 2020, 30 years ago, this month, in fact, this week. And those of you that were on active duty back then would certainly remember what was going on 30 years ago this week. It was the beginning of Operation Desert Shield. August the 2nd was the day that Iraq invaded Kuwait. And within a few days, U.S. forces were starting to deploy to Saudi Arabia, Oman, some of the neighboring countries in the Arabian Peninsula and in that region. And I remember I was on active duty, and I was working at a base legal office in North Carolina, Seymour Johnson Air Force Base. I know, Rick, your son-in-law is a pilot there at that same base now, but yep. That base was one of the first bases that was deploying planes and support personnel overseas. And, in fact, that the mission of that base, one of its areas of the world that it was responsible for in case of a war, was what they called Southwest Asia, the Arabian area. And I remember I had just arrived at that base from an overseas assignment in February of 1990. And when I arrived at the base, my boss gave me a driving tour of the base to let me know where everything was, basically. And there was this one section of the base that they called the SWA area, Southwest Asia area. It was a big storage area where they had lots of vehicles and other equipment that was painted a light desert brown color, which in northeastern North Carolina, where everything is green, it was quite a contrast. And of course, in February 1990, no one had any inkling that it's 6 months later, that storage lot area was going to be emptied. All those vehicles and all that other supply equipment had been packed on planes and was over in Saudi Arabia. It was quite a time. The base was in 24 hours operations. My office, which was a legal office, we were in 24-hour operation working in shifts, and we were doing all sorts of things, from rather mundane but very, very high-volume business of preparing wills, powers of attorney for people that were deploying. We were doing briefings for air crews, refresher training, basically, a law of armed conflict, those sorts of wartime issues. We had planes deploying not just from our base, but from bases across the country that were hopscotching their way overseas. They'd stop at our base on their way over. So it was an incredible time. It was very it was very different from what had just been the mundane work of let's say just a month before that. It was like the difference between September 10th, 2001 and September 11th. What a different difference one day makes. But I was thinking, I've been thinking, you know, as this month began, it was 30 years ago, and not just because of the significance of what that meant for the military and so many veterans that we now help 30 years later, things like disability claims to the VA and other issues, but because when you think about it from simply a war and peace issue, 30 years ago was the beginning of basically nonstop involvement of the United States in that part of the world. You know, Desert Shield was the build-up phase from August of 1990 until the war started in mid-January of 1991, where they changed the name then from Operation Desert Shield to Operation Desert Storm. It was a relatively quick war, but very violent war. It lasted about 6 weeks. Most of that, you know, that first month or so was nonstop air bombardment of Iraq. And the base I was at, we lost a couple air crew that were, their plane was shot down. Another plane was shot down, and the pilot and the weapons officer were captured, and they were POWs for, you know, 6-8 weeks. And it was quite a time. But when the war ended, late February, early March in 1991, and the troops started coming home, the U.S. left and then continued basically a perpetual rotation of other troops. And I went over myself to Saudi Arabia a year later and served there and at Dahran, Khobar Towers, and temporary duty at a couple places on the west side of Saudi Arabia. But it was nonstop presence over there because even when Iraq was kicked out of Kuwait, the United States, rather than overthrowing Saddam Hussein back in 1991, they left him in power, but we were enforcing no-fly zones. So we had planes flying all over Iraq, and sometimes there were confrontations. But eventually, it, as we all know, 12 years later, it led to the invasion, 2003. And it's been a time of warfare pretty much ever since then, also with Afghanistan after the 9/11 attack. But in any event, bringing this back full circle, this month of August of 2020 is really the 30th anniversary of not just Desert Shield, but a major change in U.S. War and foreign policy that has put us basically on a war footing for the last 30 years. I just wanted to mention that because there, you know, so many veterans that listen to our show and that we help in dealing with the VA are veterans of Desert Shield, Desert Storm, or sometimes referred to as the First Gulf War, as well as the more recent generation that has served since 2001 in Afghanistan, and since 2003 in Iraq, and now other countries around that. So before we go to the news, I just wanted to mention that. Any thoughts, Rick? I know you said your son-in-law serves at that same base now. He's an F-15E pilot, right?
He's getting ready to head out to England in 2 months, where he's going to be training, and they'll be there. They'll be stationed there for the next 3 to 5 years.
Yeah. Well,
he flies the F-15, which I guess, I don't know if you're right, but Boeing is, I guess there's a contract for 72 new F-15s.
And yeah, he flies the
eight are going to be done.
Yeah. So, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
and they're working on 8 right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when I had arrived at Seymour Johnson in February 1990, the wing there was in the middle of transitioning their aircraft to the new F-15E model. The E model was not only had the air-to-air capability of a fighter plane, but it was a two-seater, and it had a significant air-to-ground, in other words, bombing role. I think it could carry like 12,000 or 24,000 pounds of munitions, and it was all-weather fighter bomber, it was quite the aircraft, for the Iraq War there, and in any event, it's 30th anniversary. It's kind of a time of remembrance. Those who were on active duty certainly will remember that time and the effect that it had on their lives, as well as the country. Because, like I say, the decision to ramp things up and make it a major military confrontation rather than work out some other non-war, some sort of peaceful negotiation to convince Iraq to go ahead and get out of Kuwait, but also to settle its grievances that it has with Kuwait. They claim Kuwait was stealing its oil, that some of the other countries in the region were mistreating Iraq over some debt issues. Historians, you'll recall that Iraq and Iran had just been in an 8-year war from 1980 to 1988, and just 2 years after ending that, what does Iraq do? They invade Kuwait, setting off this whole cycle. And some will make the strong argument, I believe, that it was our presence over in Saudi Arabia, which is really anathema to that country, which is a very conservative Muslim country, to have Western troops stationed in their land, that it was one, our continued presence there was one of a number of reasons cited by Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda for the September 2001 terrorist attack. So in any event, it's something that I think needs to be, the lessons from that war and the subsequent wars need to be studied, and perhaps on some future shows we can discuss those more. So, all right. With that, let's go ahead and turn to some news. I've got several items of news to report, and I know, Rick, you do as well. The first one deals with what might at first blush appear to be somewhat of a mundane issue, which is health records. But it is important because a lot of veterans, they serve in the military. They'll have their military records. Then they start dealing with the VA, and they get a separate system of records. Well, in recent years, the VA has been trying to modernize its health record system to make its electronic health records link with Department of Defense health records to create a lifetime of seamless care, basically, for service members and veterans. Rick, I know you and I have represented a lot of veterans, going back to veterans who served as far back as the Second World War, Korea, many in Vietnam, and even subsequent decades, when the records were all paper records. And even though they subsequently, in recent years, the VA has made an effort to convert those paper records to electronic records, we know that just the nature of the time frame when historically records were kept just on paper, that the records sometimes had questions about them, whether they were complete, whether they were thorough, whether they're even readable, because they're often, written just in ink. And, there's the old story of how doctors' handwriting is so bad. Certainly, I know we've seen records, but the idea now that records would be more legible, certainly more complete, more thorough, more self-explanatory because of the use of computers. This program, which the VA calls the Electronic Health Record Modernization Program, is really part of a 10-year program with the VA. And the recent news from this past Friday, August the 7th, is that the VA announced that there were some COVID-19 pandemic caused delays in the program, but now the VA has revised its schedule. It's converting facilities to its new electronic health records capabilities. In August, they're focusing on Columbus, Ohio, in October in Spokane, Washington. The idea is that this program, once it's finally completed, will make it easier for the VA, for DOD, and certainly for service members and veterans to have more accurate, more thorough records and have easier access, better for continuity of care, those sort of things. If any of you are interested in learning more about this electronic health record modernization program, they've got a website, which is ehrm.va.gov. All right, let's go over to Rick Hurley.
All right. In other news, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs announced on August the 7th that it will begin awarding more than $400 million in grants under the Supportive Services for Veterans Families Program, SSVF. To 266 nonprofit organizations in all 50 states, the District of Columbia, Guam, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands on October 1st of this year. The SSVF funding provides thousands of low-income veteran families around the nation with access to case management and other assistance to rapidly rehouse veterans who become homeless or prevent veterans from becoming homeless. Helping veterans exit homelessness and remain in stable housing is more important now than ever, said VA Secretary Robert Wilkie. The Supportive Services for Veterans Families Program remains a vital resource to ensure that every veteran has a safe and stable place to call home, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. In fiscal year 2019, SSVF served 156 individuals, including 70,524 veterans, 20,608 children. As a result of these and other efforts, veteran homelessness has been cut in half since 2010's launch of the Federal Strategic Plan to Prevent and End Homelessness. Since then, VA's homelessness program and targeted housing vouchers provided by the Department of Housing and Urban Development have placed hundreds of thousands of veterans and their family members into permanent housing or helped to prevent them from being homeless. For more information, visit the website at va.gov/homeless. That's va.gov/homeless. Well, that sounds like a good positive story for these turbulent days.
Yeah, it's always good to hear that there's more focus to try to help those that are homeless or facing homelessness, and these tough economic times certainly is more, there's that greater problem. In other news from the VA, they released data this past week showing a significant increase in the use of the VA's online tool to help veterans make informed decisions about their health care, and that program is called My Health eVet. From January to June of this year, veterans and their providers exchanged more than 11.6 million secure messages through My Health eVet, which is a 24.1% increase compared to the same period in 2019. Veterans also made more than 11.2 million prescription refill requests through My Health eVet, an 8.1% increase compared to the same period in 2019. According to VA Secretary Robert Wilkie, quote, VA's longstanding priority is to make sure veterans have a convenient way to manage their health through telehealth technologies is proving successful. Investing in the development of the infrastructure early gives us the ability to quickly adapt to the current health care environment, unquote. Now, the VA attributes the increase in the use of its online health care tools to its proactive approach to keep veterans and the VA providers safe during this COVID-19 pandemic. Through My Health eVet, the online website, veterans can request VA prescription refills, review their VA medical records, and connect with their VA providers by exchanging secure online messaging. My Health eVet is a program of the VA's Office of Connected Care, which works to extend veteran care beyond the traditional office visit. Back to you, Rick.
Thank you, David. The U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, in partnership with the Elizabeth Dole Foundation, announced on August the 5th the launch of a new foundation program granting family caregivers access to no-cost short-term aid to help those caring for wounded, ill or injured veterans or service members in their homes during the coronavirus pandemic. Under the Respite Relief for Military and Veteran Caregivers Program, caregivers of veterans can apply to receive approximately 24 hours of respite care from a CareLinks professional to help with bathing, companionship, cooking, exercise and grooming, light housekeeping, medical and medication reminders, mobility assistance, transportation, and other activities. Caregivers charged with caring for our nation's veterans face new challenges during the COVID-19 pandemic, said VA Secretary Robert Wilkie. They have become increasingly isolated and are hindered from getting reliable outside help. This program provides caregivers passionate and needed relief during this stressful time. Respite Relief for Military and Veteran Caregivers will initially be available in select regions of California, Florida, and Texas. The EDF will work to expand the program to other regions of the country later this year. AARP will also be supporting the effort by sharing information about the program with their members in the selected states. Applicants to the Respite Relief for Military and Veteran Caregivers program will be selected and awarded by the Elizabeth Dahl Foundation. You can apply at hiddenheroes.org/respite. That's hiddenheroes.org/respite. Back to you, David.
All right. A week ago, August the 3rd, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs announced that it is collecting laptop and mobile phone donations through an established partner nonprofit organization called America's Adopt a Soldier to help veterans at risk of or experiencing homelessness stay connected to their health care providers, case managers, and loved ones. Through these donations, veterans can access treatment plans, medical support, social networks, and more, also following the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention safe distancing guidelines during this COVID-19 pandemic period. According to VA Secretary Robert Wilkie, quote, as VA continues to provide secure, safe, and stable housing for all veterans, we're also helping them stay connected to needed services, families, and friends. This partnership makes those valuable connections possible for veterans who might not otherwise have access to mobile phones or computers, unquote. Hundreds of smartphones and laptops have already been collected through public and corporate donations. These donations have been shipped to the Veterans Integrated Service Network, or VISN 21, which includes the VA healthcare systems for San Francisco, Palo Alto, Northern California, and Southern Nevada. The laptops and smartphones will go to veterans enrolled in one of three VA programs, the Housing and Urban Development VA Supportive Housing Program, the Grant and Per Diem Traditional Housing Program, and the Health Care for Homeless Veterans Contract Residential Services Program. As additional donations arrive, America's Adopt a Soldier will work with the VA to identify additional VISNs, or in other words, the healthcare networks across the country that are in need. According to Mary Keeser, the founder and chair of America's Adopt a Soldier and a former U.S. Army officer, and I quote, while America's Adopt a Soldier has had a longstanding partnership with VA to help veterans at risk of homelessness in other ways, this project allows for the organizations to meet the urgent needs of veterans at risk of or experiencing homelessness during the COVID-19 pandemic. The success of this project will also ensure we are able to better plan for and respond to future or long-term requirements. If you want to learn more about how the VA is helping to protect veterans during the COVID-19 pandemic, you can go to the website va.gov/homeless/coronavirus.asp. Again, to learn more about how the VA is working to protect veterans during the COVID-19 pandemic, the website is va.gov/homeless/coronavirus.asp. Back to you, Rick.
Thank you, David. Back on July the 30th, the Department of Veteran Affairs announced that it has successfully reduced prescription opioid use in patients within the VA healthcare system by 64% from more than 679,000 veterans in fiscal year 2012 247,000 in fiscal year 2020 through through the third quarter. VA achieved this reduction by aggressively emphasizing the safe and responsible use of prescription opioids and transforming the treatment of chronic pain using alternative therapies and treatments often in place of or in conjunction with pain medication. Collectively, uncontrolled pain, stress, and functional impairments can reduce the quality of life for veterans and their families, increasing the risk for overdose, substance use disorders, and suicide, said VA Secretary Robert Wilkie. More than one-third of veterans in the VA healthcare system live with some form of chronic pain, and given the opioid crisis, it is our duty to do everything we can to help veterans avoid opioid overdose and provide them with alternative pain management treatment. VA's opioid safety initiative also reduced the number of patients receiving opioids and benzodiazepam together by 87% since 2012, from nearly 123,000 down to nearly 16,000 veterans, as well as reduce the number of patients on the long-term opioid medications by 70% and the number of patients on very high doses of opioids by 80%. VA has been addressing the use of opioids for more than 20 years and continually builds upon that work by employing four broad strategies to address the opioid epidemic, education, pain, risk management, and addiction treatment. VA takes an interdisciplinary approach to care focused on a veteran's whole health by using non-pharmacological complementary pain management treatments, self-care, skill building, and support to transition from a biomedical to a biosocial model of pain care. The VA's initiatives respond to the challenges of pain management. Through its opioid overdose education and naloxone distribution program, VA has distributed more than 416,000 prescriptions of naloxone, a life-saving medication used to block the efforts of a potentially fatal opioid overdose to veterans use of as of June 30th. Under the Drug Take Back program, veterans have safely returned approximately 192.3 tons of unwanted or unneeded medications as of June the 30th. Specially trained VA pharmacists have conducted more than 55,000 outreach visits with VA on VA staff on opioid safety, opioid overdose, and naloxone distribution and medication for opioid use disorder. VA healthcare providers also participate in state prescription drug monitoring programs and receive training on safe opioid prescribing and the opioid crisis. Learn about the VA Opioid Safety Initiative and or for more information on this program, go to va.gov/pain-management. This is really good news there, David. I've got a number of cases where I've actually filed claims because of my clients becoming addicted to the opioid as a result of their some back injury or some service-connected physical injury, and they were prescribed these opioids by the VA, and then they became addicted to them, and they now have physical issues with regard to the opioids. So it's good to see the VA's, stepping up and taking care of their own house. And, they were a little out of control there for a long while. And, I heard some horror stories from veterans when, they were walking out of the VA. It was like Halloween with a candy bag. And a lot of these guys had no idea what was in the bag, but it felt good and relieved their pain, but it caused many, many other problems. So good to see that they're finally clean house on this. Back to you.
Yeah, it is great to hear that they're trying to reduce reliance on opioids, although I have a concern, this is anecdotally talking to some veterans, which is, they're not giving the opioids, but they're still in pain. Their pain is not being managed. Yes, they do have all these other systems and pain management programs, but are individual veterans really benefiting from those others? Should more effort, more resources be done? The statistic that you mentioned, Rick, I thought was just mind-boggling. This drug take-back program, veterans have returned about 192 tons. Not pounds, tons of unwanted or unneeded medication as of June 30th of this year. That's just incredible. And not just as far as waste, but it makes you wonder how much more is out there that just wasn't returned but would fall into the unwanted or unneeded or just unwise category, and as well as just the tremendous waste of money that the VA has paid pharmaceutical companies, which no doubt have really been, you know, they're the legal drug pushers for their for their drugs, making a ton of money off these opioids that end up being, like you said, given out like candy at Halloween, and not needed, creating addictions, and then the rug's pulled out from these veterans, some of whom then turn to the streets for other sources of pain relief.
To show how, and here's a real life example, you know, people who are listening, because sometimes it's important to kind of actually give an example.
Yeah.
I had a veteran who he was working at the federal prison, Coleman, in Florida, and he was a senior ranking officer there. Well, he had a service connected knee injury, which he required surgery, and so he had the surgery done in, down in Gainesville, Florida. When he was finished, you know, as part of, recuperating, they gave him some opioids. This is a number of years ago. This is before, you know, the VA started really doing a heads up. So they let him, they kept prescribing the opioids for him. And he started to have problems at work because he was, taking too much of these opioids. And the VA finally said, well, enough's enough. We're going to cut you off. So they cut him off. So what did he do? He did like so many other people do. He turned to heroin because they're basically the same drug. And he turned to heroin. And at this point, he ended up losing his job at the correction center. He needed money, so he turned around and he sold some heroin to an undercover police officer, and killed two marriages during this process. And basically, he was homeless. And if it wasn't for his second wife, who literally let him live in his car in her driveway for 3 months. And during this time, you know, we were representing him, and I had actually lost track of him because I didn't know, you know, if he had no mailing address anymore. I mean, he was in the wind. And we had a really good case, good PTSD case for him. Long short of it is, you know, thank goodness for that second wife, and he started to get himself back on track again. And then we got him into Camp Hope. And you know, fortunately, the judge that was hearing the case agreed to, instead of putting him in prison, and this is a corrections officer who's now looking at going to prison, the judge agreed to make, as a condition of his sentence, successfully completing Camp Hope, which he spent 9 months, 12 months there. And he's doing great today. He's absolutely doing phenomenally well. But, you know, here's a guy that started out with a knee injury, from service. Then the VA loaded him up on opioids, got him addicted, and then his life crashed. And then, fortunately, through the nonprofit organization of Camp Hope and good family members, he was able to pick himself up by his bootstraps, and now he's doing well again. So, when you see the real life story, you can read these articles, we can do these press clippings, and you can talk about how great it is that they've reduced the numbers. But when you really hear the story and you see the consequences, you hear the consequences, for me, it brings it home, and it really makes people, understand how dangerous it could be. Thank goodness, some things fell this veteran's way and he was able to survive, because otherwise, he basically, as we say in the addiction world, he was looking at prison or death, and all because of the opioids. So, yep. Anyway, well, just wanted to share that.
Thanks for sharing that story, Rick. And I think on the plus side for the VA, I give him credit for trying to move away from the overprescription of opioids. But on the flip side, as the veteran who you just described, the flip side was having the opioids ended without a good alternative. His addiction to the opioids then just moved into the illegal use of heroin, and as you described, his life just went downhill. And before we go on to news, since you mentioned Camp Hope, and I know since you've been to Camp Hope, and some of our listeners, some of our loyal listeners may know of Camp Hope because we've had guests on, both veterans that attended Camp Hope as well as David Molesby, who's the executive director of Camp Hope and PTSD Foundation of America. Rick, if you could just, if you wouldn't mind sharing with our listeners for a few minutes exactly what Camp Hope is, where it is, what were your impressions when you went to visit it?
Camp Hope is in Houston, Texas, on the outskirts of Houston, Texas, and it sits on a 5 to 10 acre parcel of land. The best way to describe it is it's a 12-step spiritual-based rehab program focusing on veterans struggling with addiction and usually PTSD. So it's a combination of the two. And it's a phenomenal program. You know, when you first get there, you're put in for 30 days. It's called blackout time. And basically you have no contact with anybody. You don't have contact with your family. And for 30 days, it's an intense detox situation. And you basically deal with your mentor, who's another member of Camp Hope, who's looking to graduate from the program, who then gets into a mentor type of relationship. You live in a dorm style setup, very militaristic. Everybody's given a job. When you first get there, you're cleaning the toilets, and you're picking up the stuff on the grounds, and then slowly you can progress up, and you know, from washing windows to finally maybe cooking some dinners, and you attend all sorts of group therapy programs. There's a workout area. Last time I was there, they were just finishing up some additional housing units. I think they're going to have about six of them, about 600 square feet for each one, which would basically let a member of the program live an independent lifestyle but still be sitting on the ground, so that you have the comfort of knowing that you can run back into the program if you're getting a little squirrely, or at the same time you can start, you know, taking care of yourself, making your own meals. I'm not sure if they've started yet, but they're going to let you bring your family in if you were married with kids. So it's a great program. They've got, one of the things I always really thought was pretty cool is they got a fire pit. And I remember one time I was there, and I just kind of sat and listened to everybody around the fire pit. And just to listen to their stories, they were talking about their addiction, they were talking about their service, they were lending support to each other, especially the newbies coming in. It's just very, very cool stuff. In fact, I've got a client right now who is sitting in the Citrus County Jail in Florida as a result of a domestic, and he's represented by the public defender. And I just last week got my client to do a letter, and he sent me the letter, and then I wrote my own letter to the judge, attaching that letter from my client. And in the letter I mentioned to the judge that I'm trying to get my client into Camp Hope, and I described to the judge what the program's all about. And as of this morning, we just needed to get a couple of pieces of information to the judge, and he was going to release him from jail. And basically, at this point, you know, make Camp Hope as a condition of his sentence.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. I was on the phone for about an hour today with public defender trying to get his DD-214 over to her and confirmation that he's currently 70% for PTSD, and the judge just wanted confirmation that he has been diagnosed with that disability. So you know, it's good stuff. And this judge, I'm not going to give you his last name, but the first part of his name, his nickname is Hang'em. And so it's Hang'em so-and-so, and that's his reputation. He's a tough guy.
Well, the great thing about Camp Hope, Rick, that I know you've told us about in the past and our guests have told us, is even though it's in Houston, Texas, veterans from anywhere across the country can attend, and it's free. And not only that, but they provide free air travel to get there. And I know we've talked to people that have been, that it's happened quickly, like just within a matter of days.
Yeah, they go pick you up. They go get you.
It's just it can happen quickly. We're not talking some bureaucracy where you have to apply and wait for 6 months. This isn't the VA. This is a private organization that's relatively well funded, but I'm sure can always use more funds. And those of you that are interested in learning more about Camp Hope, which is an awesome organization, listen to some of our prior podcasts. Earlier this year of 2020, we had David Malsby on the show. He also appeared on our show back in September of 2017. And in the last 3 years, we've had several guests. Rick, you'll probably remember their names. Several guests that actually went through the Camp Hope program. So it's very worthwhile. Don't let the distance deter you. And Rick, as you said, it might work very well as part of, you know, we see a lot around the country of these veteran treatment courts, the civilian courts, criminal courts that have a division to deal with veterans often who have PTSD or substance addiction problems. And they get into legal problems, not for all legal problems, but for certain ones. This veteran court is an option, and as part of this treatment aspect of it is important. So check out our prior podcasts on Camp Hope, and you also on those you'll have the websites. You can learn more about Camp Hope. Okay, let's go to we've got about 15 minutes left in today's show. Let's go to some other news. In news from Military Veterans Advocacy, one of my favorite veteran groups. It's a Louisiana-based veteran advocacy group. They filed suit in July against the Secretary of Veteran Affairs, Robert Wilkie, in a Washington, D.C. court. The suit seeks a review of a decision by the Undersecretary for Benefits, Paul Lawrence, in refusing to issue rules to govern herbicide exposure. No hearing date has yet been set, but Military Veteran Advocacy Board Chairman and Director of Litigation, Commander John B. Wells, U.S. Navy retired, said the lawsuit was necessary to force the VA to comply with the realities of toxic exposure on the Central Pacific Islands. According to retired Commander Wells, who also is an attorney as well as advocate for veterans, he said, and I quote, "We have definitive proof of the presence of dioxin and other toxic chemicals on Guam 40 years after the last known use. We also have affidavits that we have provided the VA for personnel who sprayed the herbicide," unquote. A recent report prepared for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency analyzed soil samples taken in October 2019, which noted, and I quote, "It is probable that TCDD, dioxin cogener concentrations detected in soils are associated with chlorinated herbicides. Records of chlorinated herbicide used by the military on Guam and veteran affidavits documenting the use of these herbicides, along with data collected from previous soil samples, suggest the presence and use of herbicides was likely. And finally, herbicides in question were known to contain TCDD. The soil samples were taken at locations identified by former Military Veteran Advocacy Board member Brian Moyer, who also founded the Agent Orange Survivors of Guam organization. Brian Moyer served as a Marine on Guam and vividly remembers the spring. MBA Executive Director Colonel Rob Manis, U.S. Air Force retired, who also served on Guam, said, and I quote, "It is a shame that veterans have to fight for their benefits when the vast weight of the evidence indicates exposure. The VA's denial was simply irrational." Current MVA Director of Central Pacific Islands, Technical Sergeant Gary Noy Garvin, U.S. Air Force retired, also decried the VA action. As he said, and I quote, "The evidence is clear. We were exposed to the chemicals on Guam while we were doing our duty. The VA has promised to take care of us, but has not." John Wells, who along with Moyer is advocating Congress and with the VA to provide coverage, predicted the court will be sympathetic to the veterans. Unfortunately, he said, the VA has a well-deserved reputation of delaying and denying claims until the veteran dies. Hopefully the court will force them to do their jobs. You can find out more on militaryveteransadvocacy.org website. Okay, back over to you, Rick.
Thank you, David. We have news from the National Veterans Legal Services Program website, NVLSP.org. The issues involve veterans who are entitled to VA health care but who faced a situation where they had to seek emergency care in private hospitals, who then sought reimbursement from the VA, which then refused to pay. I have one of those going on right now. In 2018, two veterans who filed VA claims for reimbursement of their emergency medical expenses, Amanda Wolf and Peter Boschinger, filed a class action lawsuit against the Department of Veteran Affairs. The lawsuit was filed in the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims and is known as Wolf versus Wilkie. The two veterans were represented in the Wolf lawsuit by the National Veterans Legal Services Program and Sidley Austin at no cost to the veteran. NVLSP is a nonprofit veteran service organization founded in 1981 that has forced the VA over the last decade to pay billions of dollars in VA disability and health care benefits to more than 100,000 veterans and their survivors. Sidley Austin is a private law firm with many lawyers who spend their time representing veterans for free. Two veterans who filed the Wolf lawsuit had been receiving their health care at the VA, but then experienced a medical emergency that required them to go to a non-VA hospital for treatment. They incurred thousands of dollars in emergency medical expenses at the non-VA facility. They both had private health care insurance, like Medicare or employee-based health care. That paid part, but not all, of the emergency medical expenses. They applied to the VA for reimbursement, and of the part of the emergency medical expenses that was not covered by their private health care insurance. The VA denied these reimbursement claims for the same reason. VA said that they could not reimburse veterans for the co-payments, deductibles, and co-insurance payments they owed under the private health care insurance policy. NVLSP believed that although VA could legally deny reimbursement for co-payments, it was against the law for VA to refuse to reimburse veterans for deductibles and co-insurance payments they owed under their private health care insurance policy. The NVLSP also knew that the VA had denied reimbursement to many other veterans for their deductibles and co-insurance. So in an effort to force the VA to reimburse all of these veterans for their deductible and co-insurance payments, the NVLSP filed a class action lawsuit with Amanda Wolf as the lead representative of the class.
Yeah, well, that's a question that many veterans may now face, which is, how can you tell whether you're a member of the class in this class action lawsuit, Wolf versus Wilkie? In September of last year, U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims certified the case as a class action, so its ruling will affect all veterans who fit within the court's definition of that class, which includes all veterans who, number one, filed a VA claim for reimbursement of emergency medical expenses at a non-VA facility, and number two, received VA correspondence stating the VA denied their reimbursement claim for co-insurance and deductible amounts owed under the Veterans Health Insurance Plan. This means you are a veteran of the Wolf class if you've ever received VA correspondence stating the VA denied your reimbursement claim for co-insurance and deductible amounts you owed under your health insurance plan. Now, there's a lot to this, and Rick, we can go over some of the commonly asked questions, but a good source for more information is the National Veterans Legal Services Program website, which is nvlsp.org. They've got a tab there at the top for Wolf class members, and that's Wolf, W-O-L-F-E, as in Wolf versus Wilkie, the lawsuit. Rick, anything you want to add about the Wolf case?
Well, just that, just to let everybody know that the court did rule that the Emergency Care Fairness Act prohibits the VA from denying reimbursements for deductibles and co-insurance that veterans owed their health insurance policy for emergency medical expenses incurred at the non-VA facility. This means that the VA denied some or all of your claim because they were deductibles or co-insurance under your insurance policy. The VA must re-decide your reimbursement claim. court also ordered the VA to identify all veterans who meet the definition of the class in the Wolf case and notify each of them about the court's decision, and that the VA will re-decide their reimbursement claim. As a result, the VA now has identified 72,000 veterans who meet the definition of the class in the Wolf case. The VA will begin mailing notices to each of these veterans. Actually, it started May 11th and it ended August 3rd. The notice tells the veterans that he or she is a member of the class, that the VA will re-decide the veteran's claims and issue a new decision, and that there's no action the veteran needs to take at this time. This means that you have already received this notice. If you've already received the notice, you are a member of this class. So, you know, that's good stuff, because I've run across this a bunch of times, and I'm sure you have too, David, where, you know, a veteran can't get to the VA facility, ends up going to a local hospital, and then looking for reimbursement for some copayments, and the VA says, no, we're not going to do it. I even had a case, David, where the VA doctor, they called the doctor in Gainesville and said, look, I can't make it. And the VA doctor said, go to your local hospital. And he did. He did exactly what the VA doctor told him to do. And then he tried to submit the deductible to the VA, and the VA said, no, you should have gone to the doctor in Gainesville.
Wow. Wow. So now they've identified at least 72,000 veterans that fall under this, that are affected by this lawsuit. There might be more out there. I heard from several veterans back in June and July that were already receiving those letters. And since now it's August the 10th, I guess theoretically all those notice letters from the VA should have gone out already. But if any of our listeners are veterans that had issues or fighting with the VA over reimbursement of care in non-VA facilities, check out the website NVLSP for National Veterans Legal Services Program .org, and they have a tab there for Wolf class member. So they also have more information. They have a form you can fill out and get NVLSP to give you some assistance, confirm whether actually you're a member of the class of that lawsuit or not, and provide other advice. All right, we're running towards the end of our show tonight. Rick, why don't you talk about the Coaching Into Care program?
Yeah, that's a great idea. We close every week with the Coaching Into Care, and this program helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching Into Care program offers coaching to help you help your veteran. That number is 1-888-823-7458. Again, 1-888-823-7458. The hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Again, the VA's Coaching Into Care number is 1-888-823-7458. Also, I want to remind listeners that suicide amongst veterans is unfortunately very high. It's a crisis in this country. The U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs has a Veterans Crisis Line. That number is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line can help. That number is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Back to you, David.
Thanks, Rick. Well, it's about time for us to go for this evening. I'd like to thank all of you for listening to the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio Station 1. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Corey and Early Law Group, which represents veterans and VA disability cases. If you're interested in being a sponsor or advertiser on our show, please contact us. Our contact information, phone numbers, and emails are on our show website, which is bbsradio.com/the Veterans News Hour. I'd like to thank our producer, Mr. Doug Newsom at BBS Radio, and we hope you'll tune in next week, same time and station, 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Mountain, and 4 p.m. Pacific, bbsradio.com, station 1. If you're interested in being a guest or you know someone you think might be an interesting guest to talk about veteran issues, please just let us know. and we'll be happy to have them on our show. Until then, I hope you have a safe and healthy week, and take care.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on VBSRadio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.